CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment today, folks, is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened.
In this segment of our show, Holly Wheeler will be telling us about Indiana Family to Family.
So if you could introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about Family to Family, that'd be great.
Sure. I'll let Reagan start. Reagan, why don't you start? Yeah, sure, great. I'm Reagan Swald. I work with our Indiana Family to Family, which is our state affiliate, and we have a really great team, and we serve our families and professionals who work with them all over the state of Indiana.
And I'm Holly Wheeler. I'm the executive director of Indiana Family to Family, and INF2F, as we call it, serves the state of Indiana. So it's a statewide family-led organization that, through the power of shared experience, provides information, training, and resources, as well as one-on-one support to families who have children with additional or special healthcare needs and disabilities, and the professionals who serve those families and children. And what makes us a family-led organization, makes us a peer-to-peer organization, is that all of our staff who work with families and all of our staff in general have raised or are raising a child with a special healthcare need or disability. So that's where the family-to-family, caregiver-to-caregiver, peer-to-peer model comes in.
So
we all, yes, please.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just going to ask, how do you go about reaching out to those who could potentially benefit from your work, reaching out to the disability community and their families?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's the first step, is letting people know that we're there. We work hard to establish relationships in the community with schools and medical professionals and so on. But I also think, Holly, you might agree, I think word of mouth is a really big part of it. If we work with a family, they talk to another family and say, hey, these people can help you figure out what you need to know. And social media is also a really significant part of how we let families know that we're there.
Yeah, absolutely agree, Reagan. I mean, there are families who receive information and recommendations from a provider or a teacher saying you should call and in a family to family, they can support you. But I think that our biggest source of families is the internet. There's a lot of disability specific or parent groups or support groups online, and families share information about us there, or just by that word of mouth, like one parent or caregiver talking to another. And that's really great. So, you know, we rely on that, but we also all work with a lot of community partners to get the word out as well.
So in that sense, what are some of the most commonly requested supports? I mean, having a network put together, I'd imagine there are some things that parents and caregivers are seeking help for more commonly.
I'll let Regan handle that question.
Yeah, I can think of two major things. One piece, which is so important because it underlies everything, is understanding healthcare financing. In other words, how do we pay for that healthcare that this loved one who has additional needs is going to need? Our system, you know, in the States, it's a mixed private and public system. And people with disabilities, including young people, can often access that public system, you know, which can provide, in most cases, better supports than our private system for people with disabilities. But one of the tricks is that system is based in each state. So if you move even to a neighboring state, for example, you have to start all over. And that can be really overwhelming for a family. So parents who have walked that road, we are really well positioned to help other parents figure that out. Because if you don't have your kids' healthcare financing figured out, everything else feels really, really scary.
So for each of you, in your time with Family to Family, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you where you were able to provide especially meaningful guidance and support?
That's a great question. Sometimes, you know, the work is really, it can be really challenging because we can't solve every problem. That's not realistic. And that can make the days feel not so great. But then, as you say, there are those moments when you feel like, you know, I really did help that family. I can think of a family who was just really having very, very big difficulties getting some really important equipment paid for their child. Again, our system is so fragmented and complex. So teaching this family about how the systems work, how you can appeal, what information is going to get that to happen. Sometimes it feels overwhelming and it's not all going to happen in one day. But when the parent has that success and then they feel like they are empowered to take on that next challenge by themselves, or even better, to help another family meet their challenge based on what they learned, like, that makes you feel so good. Again, we can't fix all the problems, but we can try to give families the tools to advocate for their families, and then ideally help their young people learn to be their self-advocates.
So,
yeah, and I just want, if I could just add on, I don't work directly with the families. I'm more of an administrative role. But our goal is that families can advocate for their child by, you know, helping them understand a very complex system and really to have that ripple effect where one family can share that information and knowledge with another and really be leaders. And that helps promote autonomy, but it also helps families feel like they have some control, because sometimes they just don't feel like they have much control over what's happening with their child. So it's really, really helpful if they can kind of pass that torch one family to another.
So where can people go about finding more information about the work you do?
Well, we are very active on social media. We have a website, inf2f.org, and our website has many resources. So we have about 90 fact sheets. Many of them are in Spanish. Some of them are in Burmese and Hokkien, which are emerging languages here in Indiana. Like, we have many refugees. We have many social media platforms. So we have Facebook pages in both English and Spanish. We have Twitter or X in both English and Spanish. We also have Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok. I know there are more. Oh, yeah. Pinterest and LinkedIn pages. We also have a YouTube channel which has many training videos, because we want families to be able to learn about topics on their own. So we have the fact sheets, we have the resource guides, and we have the training videos that are available on demand. And we are often out in our communities at events and where we share information with families directly.
Like,
yeah, and hearing Holly talk about all those social media, it kind of seems overwhelming. And I think there was a time when our organization did a lot of, like, almost like matchmaking. We would, organizations like ours would find a parent who needed to talk to another parent. Well, in some ways, it feels like social media makes that easier for parents to do on their own. But the flip side of all this information available is that the internet is an overload of information.
Yeah.
I can speak for myself as a parent who was once trying to figure out my child's new and pretty rare diagnosis. There was just too much information available. I didn't know what was accurate, what was old, what was not relevant to us. And so when I was able to find the information that this organization has, the organization which I now work for, it really did clarify everything and made me feel more confident that I knew what I was doing. So it's really, really important for me to help families understand the facts and what applies to you and what things you don't need to worry about right now.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you could stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Thomas Jankowski will be telling us a little bit about nurse practitioners and potential improvements to the healthcare system. So recently, there was an article concerning nurse practitioners and improving the healthcare system. What can you tell me about that?
Well, a number of things, really. You know, as we all know, the healthcare system is in dire crisis. Many of us within the system believe that it's only going to get worse. So a lot of people are looking for solutions to the problem. And we know that the biggest issue within the healthcare system is lack of adequate supply. And that's where nurses come in. Right now in the province of Ontario, we have just under 14,000 MDs doing family medicine, and that number is dwindling. And even with that number of MDs, there's tons of people without access to a doctor in the province. At the same time, we have over 100,000 nurses in the province of Ontario. So with that potential supply, if we could convert some of these nurses and empower them to become nurse practitioners, they could potentially fill in quite a lot of these spots. You know, I call it the best band-aid solution we have, potentially. But it depends on a number of things. It depends on the healthcare system actually allowing them to practice within the same scope of practice as NPs have in a lot of other provinces. And, you know, and us kind of figuring out under which paradigm they should be allowed to function.
So I'm curious, wouldn't this have a substantial benefit for a group like the disability population, especially those who can't readily get urgent care when they need it? Someone with a chronic condition, this would seem to have long-term lasting benefits.
Absolutely. I think any sort of marginalized group, whether we're talking about people living in the rural communities, you know, in the mid to far north, the indigenous population, people with disabilities, like you were saying, really all of these groups, you know, if you're anywhere outside of a major care area, major urban center, you will stand to benefit from this sort of a solution right away.
So do you anticipate any challenges in creating a model under which this could work?
Yeah, quite a bit of challenges, unfortunately. Some of them are easier than others, I suppose. There are some, I would say, partisan challenges from within the industry that will cause a bit of issues. You know, there's a bit of opposition from MDs themselves, because they see this as nurses encroaching upon their turf, potentially in the future affecting their negotiational powers. And nurses themselves don't feel like the actual landscape is ready for them without them knowing how they're going to be compensated, whether they can build a province or the federal system or something else entirely. So lots of people from within the industry have questions and are challenging what this could look like. Then you of course have the political system, both at the provincial and federal level. We know right now nurses are not covered under the Health Act, so that's something that should be amended quickly, in one way or another, by the feds. And we also know that within the province, there's a bit of a back and forth on enabling some private delivery of care, but at the same time not doing it with all groups, a bit of picking and choosing. So it's a bit of a minefield, but plenty of opportunity.
Are there any steps the public can take to get better informed in regards to this, so that if it does come down to a question of will the public support this idea, they'll have an informed viewpoint?
Well, even when you say, the very question of supporting this idea can mean at least two different things, even in the public's eye. Because the nurses themselves are not covered by OHIP under the Health Act, we have the potential to either allow what's being called a loophole to continue and allow NPs to have private pay clinics, which many feel is a contentious idea, because I think it's a slippery slope. It can lead to a system similar to that of the used in the US. But it's a model that's adopted by almost actually every other OECD country other than ourselves. So if you look at places that are really good that allow NPs to run private clinics, like Germany, like France, like Norway, which has a really awesome system, like Australia, we could come up with a version of this, even if it's a pilot, even if it's a way to just try this out, see what happens for a period of a year or 2 years, learn from this, see how the public reacts, and then come back to the table and say, this was actually a lot better than we expected, or no, this was a bad idea. So that's really option one, under which we could try to get the public to say yay or nay. And then option two would be to push the MLAs and MPs to say, let's change the Health Act in the next 60 days, because there's nothing stopping us from doing so, and actually enabling these MPs to open up and run their own clinics.
What would the ideal outcome be?
I don't think anybody knows, really. I think the ideal outcome right now is a place that elevates the system from where we are today to anything that's better. And because we know that right now, like I said initially, supply is the biggest issue, enable that supply through whichever path. The path really doesn't matter in the short term, whether we call it a private pay pilot or enabling them to do something else or something else entirely. Just enable something that doesn't feel like a loophole, that simply allows more healthcare practitioners to be injected into the system as quickly as humanly possible. The budget doesn't, call for this enough. If you look at the enablement of nurse practitioners by the Ford administration this year alone, they've said that they will enable up to 350 nurse practitioners to be trained every year. That's 350 nurse practitioners out of a total population of 100,000 nurses. That's nothing. That's a drop in the sea. How do we enable tens of thousands of nurses to upgrade their skill sets to become NPs, in the next year or two? That would be a win.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey, CGEM listeners. Looking for more ways to connect with CJAM programming? Try streaming CJAM through iHeartRadio. Listen online, download the iHeartRadio app, or use your smart speaker. Okay, Google, play CJAM on iHeartRadio. No matter where you are, experience CJAM FM on higher ground.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Reagan's Wall and Holly Wheeler told us a little bit about family to family, and we heard about the benefits of nurse practitioners from Thomas Jankowski.
In this segment of our show, Sasha Beck will be telling us a little bit about paratriathlon. So if you could tell me a little bit about your experiences with paratriathlon, that'd be great.
Sure. I'm Sasha Beck. Right now, I coach paratriathlon and paracycling. I got into the sport because I used to compete in triathlon myself, and then there was an athlete that was looking for a guide. She was visually impaired to compete with her at some of her international events, and then she was hoping to compete in the Paralympic Games. So about 4 years out from the Paralympic Games, I drove to Ottawa, which is about 5 hours from where I live, met with her, and had a chance to get on a tandem bike together for the first time. And did not know what I was doing, but thought, well, this sport looks really interesting. And I've always been someone who competed in an individual sport, but was very much a team player. So this was kind of up my alley. And we just hit it off personality-wise, and the speeds in which that we raced at were really similar. So I ended up spending my summers with her. 10 days after we met, we flew to Mexico. We raced together. We came home with a bronze medal. And then 3 years later, we had qualified for the Rio 2016 Paralympic Games. So we went to Rio and competed in the very first year that paratriathlon was allowed into the Paralympic Games. So they only allowed 10 people in the entire world to go participate in our category. So I felt really fortunate that we were able to make the top 10 in the world and then go compete on the international stage.
So
from there, yeah, go ahead.
So I'm just wondering, do you find that the Paralympics are as well regarded as the able-bodied equivalent? Do you find there's enough recognition for these athletes who have achieved this incredibly high level?
It's a really great question, and probably the first thing I noticed when I had qualified for the Games and got into the Paralympic sport is no. It's completely different. A lot of people don't know what the Paralympics are or think it's the same thing as the Special Olympics. Until recently, the Paralympics weren't on CBC itself. So when I went to Rio, a lot of people were just videoing on their phones and then posting them on Facebook groups for the rest of the world to see whoever wanted to watch their country compete. So I'd say the scale of recognition that you qualified for Games, as well as the televised part of the actual Games when you're there, is totally different and a lot less than what you see with the able body or Olympic Games.
So, that being said, do you find that these athletes still put on as much of a show, that they put in the same amount of athletic ability when it comes to their sport?
I think so, yeah. I think it's still like the largest sporting level that they can get to. It's the highest level that they can get to. So I think within the bubble of the Paralympic sporting world, it's still a massive achievement. And usually it's a long process to get there. So you've kind of developed your small support network that usually comes there. I think, yes, I think that every athlete is always looking for a little bit more recognition, or especially our gold medalists. They're recognized at the national sporting organization level, but really no one knows about them. So I think, especially coming out of the Games, there's a big downturn after it, because it's like the highest level of competition you've achieved, and, you know, besides your support system, no one else really knows about it. So, but no, I think every athlete still shows up and puts on their best race.
So, how do we as a society get around those instincts that say this is a one-off event and the rest of the time it's just not something we're going to look into? How do we get people to recognize that this is
a lifelong process that these athletes are training and pushing themselves every day to be ready.
I think one thing first is just educating that there is, what are the differences between Olympics, Paralympics, Special Olympics? How often do they happen? And I know some organizations like Jumpstart have picked up on the Paralympics and are kind of following the journey of athletes now. So I think the rise of social media, that's been a little bit helpful. And, you know, in terms of funding towards the Games and Paralympics itself, that increased. I think that's promoted more people to publish things on social media. So I think it's going to have to be definitely a societal change of knowing the same effort level for people competing in the able body or the Olympic Games as it does for the Special Olympics, as it does for the Paralympics. And it's not just, oh, hey, I showed up to one race and I qualified. It's a lifelong commitment, and there's, you know, people that are training 20 to 30 hours a week and trying to still maintain jobs and stuff. Like, it's a huge, massive achievement. And you have people that have overcome obstacles either that they've been born with or they've had an accident and they've had to overcome. And then they've achieved the highest level of competition over many years to compete at it. So I think media is going to be a big help with that, because people just need education and awareness on it, and then I think we'll see some societal change from there. And then the second part to that, I think, is on the education piece too, is para athletes can compete in able body sports. It's the same sport, you can do it together, they just might need some adaptation. So I think that's something I'd love to see more at the grassroots level. If you go down to your local public school, everyone should be playing soccer together, everyone can play soccer together. So I think that is something that we can do ourselves and start to shift our mind to from any local person, rather than thinking about it on the mass scales at the international level.
So, in your experience with parasport, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Yeah, there's a ton. I think my most recent one just comes to mind. And it is a really simple success, but it's something that almost makes me choke up every time. But recently came across an athlete who was competitive in multiple different sports, a young 20-year-old male. And he essentially woke up and, due to a couple circumstances, had to get his leg amputated. And was like, I don't know what to do anymore. Sport was kind of his life and kind of tethered him down with a lot of the craziness happening. And we know that equipment in the para world can be pretty expensive and we have to look for grants. So right now the biggest achievement was we were able to find him a running leg, and now he is able to participate in sport. And I've heard from his family and himself, all in tears, just that he could feel like himself again. So I know it's not like this massive, you know, he qualified for the Paralympic Games kind of achievement, but those are the small wins that in this community mean the world. It can make someone just feel like themselves, that they can do some of the things that they used to do. So there's tiny achievements like that. And then just competing with Christine, who I competed with in the Rio Olympic Games, it was a dream of hers to get there. And then paratriathlon, the last 100 meters is covered by this blue carpet. And just her and I were both just running through it in tears, just because it was the first time the Games had been there, about top 10 in the world. And I think something that will always give me shivers of just the things that she had to overcome in her life to get there. The fact that I was able to get there to support her through that and race alongside her literally the entire race. It just gives me shivers. It makes me feel super happy and accomplished for all these athletes.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Awesome, thank you.
Of course.
Now friends, let me leave you with a simple question today. How can we not recognize that athletes with disabilities push themselves as hard, if not harder, than their able-bodied equivalent? How can we not take the time to recognize the outstanding achievements of these incredible athletes? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.